The descent to the valley floor had been painfully slow. With the Inuit camp enough distance back to ensure that even the sheltered fires wouldn't cast enough of a glow to be picked up by the Fairbanks sentries, the last thing that the advancing pair wished to do would be to alert the men in the crow's nests by their own lack of caution. There was little that could be used as cover, and both men were frustrated by the lack of time as they reached the floor of the valley. In many ways, this presented the same problem, magnified. A glow of light from the ville spread over the low gates and out across the valley floor. There were, however, advantages to this. Beyond the cone of light, the contrast with this and the darkness was greater, which gave them some space in which to maneuver, and the sounds of the ville that also spilled out into the valley could possibly be so loud to the ears of the sentries as to make anything on the outside hard to detect. Ryan's plan was simple. Each man took a parcel of Plasex and ran on each side of the cone of light until he reached the wall. Once there, he found a way to plant the explosive by a pivotal point of the door, then get the hell back to rendezvous at the point on which they now stood. McIndoe eyed Ryan suspiciously, as though mentally checking through the plan for any possible catch that may leave him exposed. He could find none, but still he paused. Ryan wondered if the sec chief was trying to work out a way in which he could entrap his foe and yet get away himself.
Listen, you stupid bastard. I know you tried to chill us, and I know you don't want us here. But what do you want more? For your mission to succeed, or to get rid of us? If we're still standing at the end of the firefight, then we sort this out. Until then, we're pulling in the same direction, because neither of us wants to buy the farm. Does that make sense to you?
If the Inuit was surprised by Ryan's sudden cold statement of fact, he wouldn't betray his feelings.
All right. I'll tell my men. Until we're all the last ones standing, we don't waste energy trying to chill you. But after...
Good enough for me. Now let's get this done.
The two men parted company. Ryan's instincts told him that he could trust the Inuit sec chief so far. The battle for Fairbanks, now they were here, was the greater target. It was one factor less to consider. Now he could only hope that none of the Inuit on the explosives parties had been given prior orders to try to surreptitiously wipe out Jack and JB, or Mildred and Christy. But there was little time to worry about that right now. Using the darkness along the perimeters of the light cone, and the cover of the noise, Ryan had soon made the wall. He discovered the almost glass-like ice covering, and cursed to himself as he searched for cracks. He dared not try to force an opening, as he could see the men in the crow's nest from where he was standing. He edged closer to the wood and metal doors. Here there was opportunity. The roughly hewn doors were ill-fitting, and where panels of wood and metal had been joined together were seams large enough for Plasex charges. The hinged sections were also poorly fitting, gaps appearing between door and wall. His problem was to fit the Plasex and detonator without being overheard or spotted by the sec men, who hovered less than several feet above him. Despite the extreme cold, he could feel the sweat gather in the small of his back and trickle down his forehead, stinging in his good eye and slipping beneath the patch into the puckered and empty socket as he worked the Plasex into the gaps, priming the detonator. He kept looking up, almost able to smell the musk of body heat and animal skin from the guards above him. He was sure that he had to be visible in the light, at least partially. Certainly, as he looked across the 20-foot divide that was the double door span, he could see McIndoe working feverishly at his own task. The Inuit finished, looked across, and spotted Ryan. He gestured to Ryan to move back into shadow as he withdrew. Ryan placed the last detonator and stepped back, looking up as he did. The men in the crow's nests had their gazes fixed on the ridge that defined the height of the valley. It hadn't occurred to them to look down.
Thank God.
Ryan pulled back into the shadows and made his way to the point of cover where McIndoe was waiting.
Come, we don't have much time. Others must be back by now.
Ryan checked his wrist chron. The Inuit was probably right, and daylight would come soon. They began the ascent, each knowing that before they had time to rest adequately, they would once again be making the descent. But this time more openly, in an all-out attack. Dawn broke on the Inuit as they began to separate and prepare for attack. They were still far enough from the lip of the valley to be invisible to the inhabitants of the ville below, and could move with some freedom as long as they kept the noise to a minimum, something at which the Inuit were adept. Jordan and Thompson consulted with McIndoe, while the shaman looked on askance. It seemed more and more obvious that the old man wished to distance himself from the leadership, should anything go badly awry. From their small grouping, the companions could observe this clearly.
Reckon Doc out strategy to get this right?
Who knows what's going through Doc's head at any time, Jack. But it's not Doc who bothers me. What does Thompson know about this kind of firefight? And what is McIndoe going to do to help him?
You figure he knows what he's doing?
Who, McIndoe? I'd say that bastard knows exactly what he's doing. Question is, who's he doing it for? If he's going to set up Thompson to take a fall on this, then where does that leave Doc?
Where does it leave us? We've got to get ourselves out of here and try to get Doc before we hightail it. So if McIndoe decides that he's going to put us right in the firing line to buy the farm, then how do we get ourselves out of that and get Doc into the bargain without the Inuit turning on us?
If I knew that...
So it's just a matter of looking for the chance and grabbing it triple fast before they have a chance to figure out what we're doing, right?
Before they had a chance to discuss the matter further, the conference group in the distance broke up, and Thompson came bustling toward them, with Doc striding behind him. Trailing them, beckoned by the chief but showing a distinct lack of enthusiasm, came McPhee. He had the air of someone who would rather be anywhere else than here. McIndoe, watched by Ryan, moved off to start dividing the Inuit into combat units. On the faces of those closest to the companions, Ryan could see the set determination as they watched their sect chief. The way these people fought, they wouldn't rest until their enemy was dead or they themselves in the attempt. A noble determination, but one that would cause problems when the companions were attempting to extricate themselves from a combat into which they had been unwillingly pitched. By the time the trio reached them, Doc's long stride had put him in the lead of the group. The closer he got, the easier it was to see the messianic gleam in his eye. His mouth was flecked with white foam spittle at the corners, which flew in all directions as he began to speak.
Are you ready? Are you ready for the war to end all wars? We will save this tribe, and the Almighty will not have sent me in vain. I cannot tell you how good it feels to be at the forefront of this noble cause. We have just been discussing tactics and the best way to attack these heathens and take them for our own. I want you to be in the forefront of this with me, as I know deep in my bones that you're the finest fighters I have ever had the opportunity of standing shoulder to shoulder with. And I know that together we can triumph. Are you with me?
Slow down, Jordan. We'll join you, but first we have to know what you plan to do.
Aye, that makes sense.
Jordan nodded, his eyes betraying his increasing mania. It was as though a bloodlust had already infected him, before the first shot had been fired. It was no surprise to the companions, particularly to Mildred, who had noticed this tendency to hysteria in Doc many times before. The old man's psyche was so fragile that it took little to tilt him over the edge. The fact that Jordan was now reacting the same way suggested that there was more of Doc inside his head than they had any right to expect. This may be a good thing. It was extreme trauma that had brought out the Jordan persona, so perhaps another extreme trauma would elicit Doc's genuine personality from within once more. Thompson and McPhee were now with him, and had both noted the stranger's manic fervor. McPhee found it hard to disguise his disquiet with this development, but the chief seemed to take it calmly, as though this hysterical behavior were a necessary part of preparing for battle. Certainly he smoothly took over from the overwrought Jordan and explaining the tactics to the companions.
We split ourselves into small units, place ourselves around the edge of the valley, moving quickly before the sun is fully up and the plasex goes off. Once that's gone, then the fuckers down there will know we're here, so there's no point in hiding. We see what damage the plasex has done to the walls, and we try to get through any holes and go for the center of the ville, closing in and driving those we don't chill into the center, where we can fire them up.
Burn them?
Of course. That's the old way to sacrifice. We cannot build a wicker man in which to house them, but the city is their body, and so it is the same thing.
Mildred and Christie exchanged glances. Both knew enough about pre-dark religions and beliefs to know that there was a kind of logic in what Doc Jordan was saying, but there was something about his driven demeanor that was indeed worrying. This was a man on the verge of a complete mental collapse. And what of the hidden or lost Doc persona therein?
You will come with me, Jordan, and McPhee at the forefront of the attack.
What was that?
The Inuit chief glared at his medicine man.
We will head down into the valley from this point and take the gates as they are blown apart, forming a spearhead into the vale. It is my place to take the head of the attack, and I want you with me, as I trust Jordan's views on your capabilities. We have only minutes to prepare, so I leave you to brief your people and join us.
Thompson turned and walked away. McPhee tailed him with a displeased frown tugging at the corners of his otherwise unreadable face. Jordan lingered for a moment, and as he leaned in and spoke to them, There was an edge of his true personality that seemed to break through.
I know I can trust you.
He quickly turned and strode off in the wake of the chief and the shaman.
Phew! That one crazy man. Like man wanting by a farm.
Yeah, I know what you mean, Jack. If he's going to be that determined to lead the line, then we're going to have a hell of a job to get him and ourselves out of this.
That's going to be a tad difficult if we're leading that line with him. It'll be all we can do to stop running straight into the buzzsaw.
Yeah, we need to find a way to make sure that we don't head the charge. I guess what we really need to do is to persuade Jordan that his interests are best served if maybe he isn't right at the front, but in the second wave. That way we don't walk headlong into the firefight and we can shelter him.
Need watch our side, too. Fuckers not like us. Might have agreement with McIndoe, but not know if others keep to it.
True. And I figure I can trust him because the stakes are so high for him. But I can't be certain. We need to watch our own backs. Maybe take out some of the Inuit around us so we can clear a path to get the hell out.
So what you're saying is we need to watch everyone in case they want to chill us, and try to save the old buzzard who'll want to charge headlong to his own doom. Shit, Ryan, you aren't asking much, are you?
So what else is new?
First things first. Let's get Doc where we want him. And I think I may have an idea about that.
The time was approaching fast. Too damned fast for McPhee, who sat on his haunches, watching the preparations around him. The majority of the tribe had already dissipated into the half-light of the approaching dawn, leaving a number who looked to his jaundiced eye like a pitiful few to take on such a monumental task as storming the gates of Fairbanks. McPhee was no coward. Such a thing was unknown among the Inuit, whose natural disposition was to fight until the bitter end. But there was a world of difference between being a coward and being practical. He was certainly the latter, and could foresee nothing but disaster. No matter how big the holes blown in the walls around the ville, they were still outnumbered and walking into bottlenecks that would leave them lined up like sitting targets. McPhee just couldn't see the necessity of dying for no reason other than a glorious folly. And this was looking more and more just like a glorious folly. His natural pragmatism was winning out, and he certainly didn't trust the Outlanders. Why would anyone you had tried to chill sacrificially then agree to aid you in your task? Because they were offered little choice? Perhaps. But surely that would mean their imperative was to get out as soon as a chance presented itself, as it surely would in the heat of a firefight. So it was with a jaundiced eye that he saw Christy leave their group and approach Jordan, who was seated with the chief. Christy began to talk, and even from such a distance, McPhee could see that her words were making an impression on the stranger. He decided it would be best to be a participant in whatever was taking place. McPhee came in just as Christy was finishing a long, impassioned speech.
It's not right for you to sacrifice yourself. After all, if you've been sent for a reason, then surely it would behoove you to ensure that you can see that purpose through.
I can see what you mean. If this is to serve some purpose, it would be ridiculous for the chief and I to fall to the enemy before any of that purpose is realized.
But we have a duty. I do. To lead my people. I cannot stand down.
But it would not be standing down. It would be about strategy. About being there at the right moment when the people come together. And not about wasting your life before the aim is achieved.
After all, have you come all this way for nothing?
Christy could see a shadow of doubt cross the face of the Inuit chief. McPhee smiled to himself. The fool was going to fall for it. He knew Thompson, knew that the woman had played on his sense of responsibility to the tribe as a whole. This way they would keep themselves and their friend, the stranger, from the front line of battle without appearing to lose face. Certainly it meant that any last trace of trust the shaman had in them was no more. However, it would benefit him to play along with this.
You know, what the woman says makes a lot of sense. We have our own task to fulfill with this sacrificial firefight, and we do not fulfill that by buying the farm at the first moment. If we do, then this whole mission is in vain.
Jordan looked up at the shaman. His eyes were trusting, searching for guidance.
You think that this is the right thing? I can see that it is. Somehow feel that I am letting down the people I have been sent to serve.
No, you would be letting them down by being chilled before we have a chance to make good the sacrifice. Before you conceive the tribe you were sent to save.
Jordan considered this, then firmly nodded.
You're right. I have a sacred duty. Thompson, we must not go at the head of the attack.
We must hold back and follow the first wave so that we can be there when our victorious forces round up those we shall offer to the Lord.
You are right.
Praise the Lord.
Christie left them to return to the rest of the companions, but not without a sense of uncertainty. There was something about the medicine man that made her feel he was working on his own agenda and would have to be watched. Light spread across the wastelands, wiping out the glow from the valley below. Day slowly moved from the watches of the night, and around the rim of the valley, the war parties of the Inuit were ready. Gathered in small clusters, waiting at the points where the expeditionary forces had planted the Plaseks a few short hours before, they prepared for the moment when the timed explosions would signal their cue to action. The sounds of a people waiting for attack came to them from the valley below, drifting up on the breeze. The inhabitants of Fairbanks were on edge, unable to rest, knowing that an attack would come, but not when. They knew soon enough. A string of Plaseks explosions echoed around the valley, raising clouds of dust, rock chippings, and ice as the explosive rent great holes in the fabric of the Fairbanks defenses. Sections of the wall began to crumble. In some areas, holes blasted by the Plaseks were blocked immediately by falls of rock from around, then reopened as additional ripples of destruction washed away the blockages. At the gates of the build, the twin crow's nests were toppled by the blasts that split the metal and wood doors from top to bottom, splintering the thick timbers and sending shards on a deadly trajectory, killing those who were nearest the explosion. The doors fell in, scattering those in the immediate area who weren't squashed like bugs beneath the great weight. Behind the remnants of the wall, covered in dust, rock, and ice fragments, the people milled in confusion. Some were blinded and deafened, concussed by the explosions, smothered in rock dust. They wandered aimlessly, not sure of what to do. They stumbled headlong into those who had been galvanized by the onslaught, and were now spilling from the center of the ville, crowding the narrow streets as they rushed to the ramparts, leaving the gaudy houses, bars, old buildings, and newer shanties in which they lived to man the wall and defend their ville, to defend their lives. As they did, they hit those stunned by the explosions, falling over one another, fighting to get out of the way, to get at the enemy. It made them an easy target for the first wave of attack. As the explosions sounded, the Inuit war parties moved forward to the edge of the valley. To this point, they had stayed back, so they couldn't be observed from any vantage point within the ville. Now this no longer mattered. The Fairbanks inhabitants knew they were being attacked, and they knew that an enemy was without. Now was the time for the Inuit to press home the advantage the explosions and resultant confusion had given them.